This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Alrighty, so it looks like everybody's got their beer replenished and everything, so we can get going again. Just a reminder, if you are picking up or wanting to buy a copy of Airship Shaped, Joe has them, and will be happy to hand over your contributor copies, sell you extras and so on. We also have tickets for the fabulous Airship Ball, which will be happening at the end of March, which we hope you'll all be able to come along to. Enough of airships for now. Let's welcome Mr. Jonathan Pinnock.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Pinnock. I write poems, short stories, and the occasional book, some of which sort of impinge on the general area of science fiction and fantasy, which is kind of why I gate crashed this place. I should say that if I was in front of a literary crowd, I'd say I did magical realism. But, you know, we can tell the truth there. First up, I'm going to do a quick few poems to... hands up who loves poetry. Yeah, great. Okay. Henry's mum was making tea when the headmaster telephoned. There's been an accident in biology. I'm afraid your son's been cloned. And we wouldn't normally bother you except in case of disease. But from a practical point of view, we're concerned about the fees. Henry's mum became quite grim and her voice was filled with dread. How will I cope with two like him? It's worse than that, he said. We didn't notice what was wrong till it was far too late. You began today with just one son, but you finished it with eight. Next morning there was quite a crop, 32 cast from one mould, and when the process finally stopped, 512 all told. After that disastrous day, the school went to the wall. The other pupils moved away, so they renamed it Henry Hall. Group activities in class were fraught with indecision, and games were a colossal farce because they all played the same position. Exam results were uniform, both first time and retakes. They stuck to a consistent norm, including the mistakes. Careers were trivial to fix. A few took command of tanks, some went into politics, and the rest into merchant banks. And Henry's mum still makes the tea when called on by a son, each time wondering wistfully if he's the original one. Thank you. This next poem is called Grey Goo. For fans of form poetry, this is actually a double Fibonacci poem. Yeah, I'm impressed. It's one of those ones that goes, the first line has one syllable, second line has one, second line, two, three, five, eight, then five, three, two, one. Grey goo. Grey goo is such a far-fetched and absurd notion, said the nanotechnologist, staring down at the bubbling floor and wondering what had happened to both his feet. Okay, last poem. This is a love poem. Everyone's talking about depression, credit crunch and world recession, but I'm still feeling warm inside because tomorrow I marry my zombie bride. It's true her lips aren't made for kissing, the top one's there but the bottom one's missing, but she's my girl, we'll never part. Quite literally, I have her heart. I want to hold her, I want to thrill her, I want to give her some necrophilia. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, I'm overwhelmed with zombie lust. There'll be no family at the church, both sides have left us in the lurch. They were aghast to hear our news, like the Capulets and the Montagues. That's the last classical reference tonight. But I don't care, no, it's love, she's my undead angel from above. I had to woo her, I had to win her, even if she wants my brains for dinner. Okay, that's it for poetry. Now moving on to short stories. These are all, or the first few are from my collection Dot Dash, which strangely enough, I have some copies with me. Dot Dash, one thing I should say about Dot Dash is that Johnny Vegas has a copy of this, and if you don't believe me, check his Twitter feed for a couple of weeks ago. Johnny Vegas follows me on Twitter. I'm a middle-aged man, and I'm excited that Johnny Vegas follows me on Twitter. This is where it's got to. Okay, first one's called Steaming.
Terry peered at the steaming heap of undifferentiated cells and sighed. Teleport engineers arrived, he announced. You might need to think about that one a bit. Okay, that was called steaming. Next one's called Anniversary Feast. How are we on sort of bad words here?
Go ahead. We'll just put an explicit tag on.
Okay, there's only one. Jake filled up the glasses from the still and set them down on the console. Strictly speaking, this was breaking enough of the company's rules to earn him instant dismissal. But there wasn't anyone in a position to do that within several parsecs, so he reckoned that he was probably safe. And besides, this was a special occasion. Here's to another 10 years, eh? He said, taking a slug from his glass. Whew, this was powerful stuff. And then two more to landfall, said Gary, downing his in one go before handing his glass out for a refill. Some trip. You know, sometimes I wish I was one of those bastards snoozing away in the hold. You're kidding. Gary laughed. Yeah, I'm kidding. Wouldn't want anyone pissing about with me when I was asleep. Jake smiled. It was true. You got bored on a trip like this. Let's face it, being an ARC pilot wasn't exactly a demanding job. The only qualification you needed was to be so pathologically in debt that the only way to save your family was to take a one-way trip into deep space. But man, was it dull. The face painting had got out of hand. When you've got a hold full of colonists in suspended animation, it's just so tempting to take a magic marker and draw the odd moustache on a face or two. But if there are two of you, it gets competitive. And it wasn't long before the entire hold got to look like a practice session for a kabuki makeup class. That was going to take some cleaning up before they got to their destination. And, if the truth were told, they both fooled around with some of the women as well. Just a bit of fondle, nothing more, although Jake wondered about Gary sometimes. He had an odd look about him sometimes when he came back from the hold. So what's for supper, said Jake. It was Gary's turn to be in charge of the catering. Gary looked thoughtful. I fancy something a bit different. Not the usual freeze-dried shit. I think we deserve something real tonight, some proper meat. Jake raised an eyebrow. Like, where are we going to get hold of that, man? Pardon me for being a bit thick, but I don't recall passing a flock of interstellar sheep lately. Gary smiled. Jake knew that smile. It meant that Gary had one of his ideas. Remember that fire in Bay 12, said Gary. So? Remember the smell? The burning flesh? A bit like pork. Jake stared at Gary. I like pork, said Gary. Well, I'm not allowed to eat it, said Jake. Bet your rabbi didn't mention what I'm thinking of, said Gary. And are you going to fill up my glass or not? Well, what do you think, said Gary, picking his teeth. What do I think, said Jake? Well, I'm just wondering how many of those fuckers they'll miss. I mean, how many people do you really need to build a colony? Okay, this one's called Canine Mathematics. The dog stared at me with what seemed to be disgust. Look at the state of you, it said. I know, I replied, contrite. After 7 or 8 pints of lager, there's nothing much unusual about a talking dog. I say 7 or 8 pints, but drinking is subject to one of those pseudo-Heisenberg principles where the ability to measure the quantity consumed is inversely proportional to that quantity. If I'd been remotely sober, I could have probably put together some kind of formal equation. But after the aforementioned 7 or 8 plus or minus delta pints, it was a hopeless task. And I gave up after a few desultory attempts. This was before I met the dog. I was sitting on a park bench, staring down at the pool of vomit beneath between my feet. The shape of the pool was irregular, and I was considering the possibilities of complex integration around the curve of its perimeter when a further wave of reverse peristalsis forced its way out and distorted it. The dog was still watching me, suspiciously. Do you realise what you're doing to the olfactory gradients around here, it said, cocking its head on one side. How am I going to find my way past that for the next few days when there's that whiff throwing me off course? Sorry, I mumbled. The dog continued to stare at me. He was a golden retriever. I've had a few encounters with golden retrievers on my way home from drinking my time. Although that isn't to say I haven't met my fair share of spaniels, poodles and labradors. There's no real pattern to it, apart from the fact they tend to talk to me in this tediously moralistic and high-than-thou tone of voice. I am beginning to loathe dogs. How's the work going anyway, it said. It's fine. Or at least my funding's been renewed for the next year at least. Really? Yeah. Now look, I hope you don't mind, but I'd rather you didn't keep talking to me like this. People may be watching. I could help you. I doubt it. You reckon? See that vomit of yours? Here's a rough equation of its perimeter. It scrawled a few vague lines on the pavement with its paw. Ah, I said. Well, what do you think? It's just a load of scratches. The dog rolled its eyes. Well, you might think that, but I assure you that it's anything but. It called out to a passing mongrel, who came over and nodded furiously before declaring, a few inaccuracies in the high-level terms, but fundamentally sound. Then it trotted off into the night. You see, said the retriever, making a few minor adjustments, you're just not understanding the terminology. Can't you write a proper equation instead? A proper equation? You're joking. You humans make things far too complicated. I wouldn't have the time or the patience. No, if you want to understand, you'll need to learn how to do canine maths. You're taking the piss, aren't you? I said, exasperated. Certainly not. Are you? It counted. I don't need to justify myself. My mathematics is absolute. That's why it's called pure mathematics. It does what it says on the tin. There are no absolutes, said the dog. Whatever fundamental principles you derive, they'll simply reflect the way your brain is made. The same with ours, except that we learned long ago to express our mathematics in a universal language. I don't believe this. I'll prove it, said the dog, waving a paw to Ginger Tom, who was up a nearby tree. The cat leapt down and came over warily, keeping its distance. What do you think? Said the retriever to the cat. It sat staring at the scratches on the pavement for a minute or two, deep in thought. Well, it said eventually in a surprisingly deep voice, it's fundamentally sound, but you need to use a more accurate multiple of pi. Then it turned and shot up the tree again. See? Said the dog. In my office, I'm staring at a sheet of paper covered in scratches. It still doesn't make any sense to me. I lied to the dog. My funding application is still waiting approval. If I could just come up with some new insights into complex integration, I might just swing it. But I didn't get the dog's address. In any case, I have a horrible feeling that he may have been lying to me as well. Right, okay, I may all cock up reading this one. This is a more recent one. It's called The Unsleepers. Carlos had been working in the sleep deprivation unit for 6 years, longer than anyone else, in fact. According to rumour, he joined only a few months after it started up. So how did you know, Jeffries, I'd said. In the silence that followed, I learnt the golden rule of SDU. You don't talk about Jeffries, ever. After a while, Carlos forgave me and became a kind of mentor to me. Obviously, in those days, I couldn't aspire to the kind of times he was putting in. None of us could. But I tried my best. And every now and then, he would give away, as if by accident, one of his secrets. Surrender to the dreams, was one of his sayings. He'd been awake for just over a week. What do you mean? I said. Let me introduce you to my friend here, he said, jerking an arm to his left. There was no one there. Go on, said Carlos. Say hi. Hi, I said. For a moment, I thought I really did imagine someone, but it passed in an instant. Then again, I'd only been up for a day and a half myself. This guy has taught me everything I know, said Carlos. Okay, I said, but... Carlos looked me straight in the eye. He's a fucking genius, he said. He's, what's the word? I don't know, it's... Yeah, and you can shut it, you can, motherfucker. This was directed at the empty space on his right. Are you all... I said, I'm fine. Give me something to work on, I'm ready. Some of the things Carlos came up with were extraordinary. He found cures for all kinds of obscure conditions, solutions to long-standing mathematical conundrums, and some of the most exquisite fashion designs I'd ever seen. His capacity was immense, his value to the corporation incalculable. But one day, night, whatever, he suddenly stood up and said, "Enough." "Enough," I said. The word wasn't in Carlos's vocabulary. "I wasn't talking to you," he said. Then he turned to me and said, "I've had enough of this place, though. Time to go." "You can't mean it." "I can, and he says so too." He gestured with his hand. The guy on his left nodded. "It was nice to meet him, finally." "He'll show you what to do," said Carlos. I'd been warned about this moment, but Carlos was too quick. He pushed past me and raced over to the window. In one movement, he'd opened it and leapt out. I caught up with him, just in time to see his body vanishing out of sight. "So he's flying really light sex," I called down to him. "Do fucking right," he shouted back at me. It was the last thing I overheard him say. I went back and sat down. It was only much later that I remembered that we were on the ground floor. My training was complete. Carlos knew it. Okay, this one's called Camembert. When I answered the door, it was just after 11 o'clock on a bright night full of stars. She took off her helmet and shook her head so that her silver blonde hair sparkled with the light of the moon. "Hello," I said. She held out some kind of container. "Do you have fuel for my spaceship?" I didn't. "That's a shame," she said, pushing past me. "I'll have to stay over then. Do you have cheese? I like cheese." I did. She stayed for 3 months. The sex was relentless and at times quite unusual, but in the end, I got bored. "What's wrong?" she said, stroking my chest. "This isn't working," I said, moving her hand away. "Why not? We have nothing in common." "So?" I sighed. "And I'm sick of the way you keep going on about all the other planets you visited. It makes me feel quite inadequate. Also, the cheese thing is weird." She'd made me buy a new fridge just to keep all the different varieties in. "How about so many? I've never seen the problem with Cathedral City." "And finally, I don't think you've even got a spaceship." Well, I was wrong there. We spent the next 3 months touring the galaxy. We watched the twin moons rise over the planet Cazorbius 29. We flew in figures of eight around the neon geysers of Batargul Minor. We skimmed over the perpetual rolling earthquakes to scar the surface of Clatter Scratch 6 Beta. I may pronounce that wrong. I quite like the zero gravity sex too. But all was not well. "What's wrong?" I said, running my hand down her spine. "This isn't working," she said, pushing herself away from me. "Why not?" "You're boring." "What?" I couldn't believe this. I'd pandered to her every need. I'd even lugged that sodding fridge of hers all the way over to where she'd hidden the spaceship. We still hadn't run out of cheese either. "Everywhere we go, all you can ever think of saying is, 'Wow, that's amazing,' or 'Cool, brilliant,' or 'Whoa!' You have no imagination, that's your problem." I couldn't think of anything to say. She dumped me. Unfortunately, we were too far away from Earth for her to dump me anywhere near my home. However, to be fair, she did at least dump me on a planet with a reasonably well-developed ecosystem and not too many predatory species. The climate is generally favourable and there's plenty to eat. I've built myself a nice, comfortable shelter, and I've even just about got used to the 20-hour diurnal cycle. The odd thing is, it's the cheese I miss the most. I'd give anything for a wedge of camembert. Okay, last thing. This is from my first and only novel so far, Mrs. Darcy vs. the Aliens. This is a sequel to Pride and Prejudice. I take it we're all Jane Austen fans around here. The end of Pride and Prejudice ends, spoiler alert, so put your hands over your ears a bit, right? With Elizabeth Bennet marrying Mr. Darcy and Lydia, her youngest sister, marrying the disreputable Wickham. Oh, we're loping with him, rather. Oh, never mind. What Jane Austen forgot to say, that the reason why Lydia eloped with Wickham was actually because Wickham was an undercover agent and he was protecting her from alien abduction. And he did up to a point, but unfortunately, when he turned his back at one point and Lydia was indeed abducted by aliens, which is before this opened. I'll just read the prologue because I don't want to read the whole book. You might want to buy it. Elizabeth Darcy stirred in her sleep and felt the soft breeze on the back of her neck. She was awake in an instant. The curtains were wafting backwards and forwards in an elegant moonlit dance. How long had the window been open? She sat up in bed, her heart beating a furious tattoo, and her eyes scanned the gloomy room to see if there was anything out of place. Once she had established that there appeared to be no intruder compromising the security of her chamber, her breathing began to settle down to a more regular pace. Mrs. Darcy swung her legs out of bed and stood up. She lit a candle, and it was at that point that she noticed the letter. It was on the floor underneath the window. Putting down the candle, she rushed over and picked the letter up, tearing at the seal. Mrs. D, it said, come at once to McFadyen's quarry. This time, I have irrefutable evidence. Yours ever, W. Her hand shot to her mouth to prevent herself from crying out. She ran to the window and peered out into the night. For a moment, she was convinced she could hear hoofbeats, but if there were any, they were soon swallowed up in the wind. Mrs. Darcy threw on a coat over her night clothes, grabbed her riding boots, and eased open her bedroom door. She paused outside the door to Mrs. Darcy's bedroom, Mr. Darcy's bedroom, sorry, and her hand moved towards the handle. Then she shook her head. This was something she had to do by herself. She crept down the grand staircase and headed out into the night through the kitchen, pausing only to don her riding boots. Glancing around to be sure she wasn't being observed, she made her way to the stables and found her favourite mount, Kira. Speaking softly to Kira to calm her down, she led the dappled grey out and away from Pemberley until she was far enough from her house to mount in safety. And she leapt up into the saddle, kicked away with the stirrups and urging Kira on towards McFadyen's quarry as fast a pace as she dared in the half-light. Mrs. Darcy reached the quarry within half an hour, dismounted a little way before she reached it, next to a small clump of trees. There, she tied the horse up and continued on towards the quarry on foot. She was 100 yards from its rim when she caught sight of a man lurking beside a tree in the middle distance, his face darkened by a cloud passing over the moon. She immediately crouched down behind a bush, but it was too late. He had seen her. The man motioned her to stay still and be quiet. Then she saw something begin to emerge over the lip of the quarry. In the dim light, she couldn't make out what it was, but it was heading towards the stranger. She saw him draw his sword. A gust of wind caught her off guard, and while Mrs. Darcy was struggling to keep hold of her bonnet, she missed the start of the confrontation. An unearthly roar merged with the sound of the gale as the mysterious swordsman hacked away at whatever was attacking him. Something flew up in the air and landed at her feet. It seemed part of some kind of tentacle. It hissed as it landed, spurting out a bubbling yellow liquid. Up ahead, the man continued to hack away with his sword. Another revolting body part spun off and caught Mrs. Darcy full in the face. It's not foul. She wiped it away and spat on the ground in an unladylike manner. It was probably a good thing that Mrs. Darcy had not accompanied her, since she tended to disapprove of that kind of behaviour. The fight ended as abruptly as it had begun. The victor sheathed his sword and came over towards her. She struggled to her feet, attempting to brush the dirt and slime off her clothing. Good evening, Mrs. Darcy, said the man. I take it you received my note. Good evening, Mr. Wickham, she replied, looking down at the tentacle still wriggling at her feet. Once again, sir, I find myself shrouded with the debris of your encounters. Mr. Wickham, gave a slight bow. I most humbly apologise, ma'am. I had not expected to be attacked on this occasion. Thankfully, I did at least succeed in dispatching the fiend. Would that the aim of your affection were as clean as true as that of your sword, Mr. Wickham. Mrs. Darcy, as I have tried to explain on several occasions, my intentions toward your family have always been entirely honourable. Indeed, sir? Then you have certainly kept your honour well hidden. She softened slightly. So, to what do I owe the pleasure of our encounter on this windy night? I trust you're not leading me on yet another merry dance. No, indeed, Mrs. Darcy, said Mr. Wickham. I hope you know me well enough by now to trust that I shall do no such thing. No, come this way towards the quarry. I have something to show you. This time, I really do believe I know what has happened to poor Lydia. For a moment, Elizabeth was lost for words. Pray do not trifle with me, Mr. Wickham, she managed at last. Believe me, Mrs. Darcy, replied Wickham, I would never trifle with you on the subject of your sister. Remember, she was, is, also my wife. He paused and then looked her full in the eye. The truth is out there, he added significantly, though it is not yet universally acknowledged. Thank you.
Yes, Mrs. Darcy versus the aliens. It's a classic of magical realism. Okay, well, that'll do for our second reading. We'll have another swift break for replenishing the glasses, and then we will reconvene for Snobby Christians.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.